connecting to the internet.
Internet.
Networking software.
World Wide Web for the computer today.
Computer.
NetSurfer Pro.
Are you ready for your first mission with the circus?
I think I am.
Okay, then your mission is go into Larry's club and play this song over these speakers.
All right, you got it, boss.
Hey, welcome to Larry's club. I'm Dave. I'm the security guard.
Oh, are you sure your name isn't Larry?
No, Larry's my boss. He owns the club.
Oh, I see. Well, I'm Larry's brother, Harry.
You don't look Harry to me.
Oh, you see, it's a misnomer kind of name.
Oh, okay. I guess Larry isn't very Lair either. Alright, you can go in.
Yeah, got it.
And who are you supposed to be?
What
are you doing back here?
What am I doing back here? What are you doing back here?
You're right. What am I doing back here?
Oh, phew. Made a good roll. Alright, I've got the mixtape. Let's just insert it here. And play.
We don't know where Galen disappeared to that night. Some say he faced crimes for his crimes. He faced punishment for his music crimes. Some say he's still out there slinging pizzas in the sky to this day. But the truth is stranger than reality. He's on a podcast, that's the truth.
Yeah, and podcasts are pretty famously strange.
Yeah, very strange. Especially this one, NetSurfer Pro, rolling right through the World Wide Web, where I'm your main host, Matthew Marissa.
And I am, of course, your co-host, Galen.
And we are talking about a real thing today.
Yes.
If you couldn't believe it or not. I think we don't really have much of like an on-ramp here. This is just like one of those things where I think Galen played it and was like, hey, we need to do an episode on this. And I was like, yeah.
Yeah, so I did not purchase this yet, I will say. I need to. I played this off of your Steam account, and I was like, yeah, this is good enough. This needs to be an episode.
Yeah, we share games.
Yeah.
What about it?
I mean, it's no different than when you go into your house and you're like, hey, I got this game. Do you want to download it on my Steam account? And
yeah.
It's like, yeah. It's yep. Basically the exact same
it's as basically that. The exact same, yeah.
We don't need to do any litigation here.
I mean, yes, that's true. It was legal.
Cosmodee, if you're listening, please don't sue us.
There's no reason to.
If you look at Article 4, Section B, it will not say that you can legally sue us.
It's a Steam feature. A new Steam feature. Introducing Counter-Strike the Movie. Directed by Michael Bay.
Oh, no.
Starring Jack Black.
Jack White.
Jack Kirby.
Jack Quaid.
Jack Mario.
And
Jack Lynx.
And Nicolas Cage.
That's not what this episode's about.
No, no, no. Okay. All right.
We're talking about something much better than whatever we just did.
You see, this podcast is a little bit freeform, a little bit stream of consciousness, much like jazz.
Ah, I get it. We're talking about jazz? Wait, no, that doesn't sound right.
No, but we're talking about a famous thing that mentions jazz. That's right, we're talking about the B-movie.
God damn it,
wait.
I knew that was coming. We don't rehearse these, in case you couldn't tell. I know it sounds like we're very planned out and we, like, share notes and script things. No, this is off the cuff, off the top, improvisational.
Yep, much like jazz.
Yeah, so, hey, you want to go to the fact corner real quick so we can talk about our main topic, which is... Okay, well, so it's sort of a main topic. So, we originally were going to do this on one game, and then we realized it's actually more than one game.
Yes.
We're still going to mainly do it on the game that you can see as the title of this episode, but we are going to delve sort of into the greater quadrilogy series.
Yes.
Of the Off-Peak series, with the main topic, of course, being Betrayal at Club Low.
The Fact Corner.
Awesome. So, This particular game, as well as the four games that we are going to briefly discuss, the three other games we're going to briefly discuss, I suppose, are all created by a creator known as Cosmo D. Cosmo D is a person, a creator, a really good creator as well. They got into music before they got into video games. According to them, they just sort of like knew that they loved music at a very young age, got super into jazz, which you can see as a clear sort of thing they pull from in all of their games. And Cosmo apparently was a name that they kind of like, I think was dubbed to them. I'm not sure if they came up with it or if like somebody else came up with it for them, but it was essentially a name that they were like, yeah, I want to make stuff that, you know, like people sort of think about, make stuff that people, you know, like that really seems interesting and cool and weird and isn't like anything else. And good job. Like, oh my God, a lot of these games are so really, so incredibly interesting.
They succeeded on that goal.
Yep. But then they got into game development, and they made a series of games, the Off-Peak games.
Mm-hmm.
This all takes place within the Off-Peak City, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
I believe the very first game is literally called, like, Off-Peak City.
The first one's Off-Peak.
Ah, it's just Off-Peak.
Yeah.
Personally, my favorite games are On-Peak, like Peak 2 or Peak 3 from SSX 3.
Yeah, I know.
But, you know, going Off-Peak is also pretty good every once in a while.
Or Hellfire Peaks.
Yep. Peaky Blinders? That's a band. That's not show. A band. That's a band show.
Wow. So there are four games, as mentioned. The first one is Off Peak. Then there was the Norwood Suite. Then Tales from Off Peak City, which has exactly one episode.
Yep.
And then Betrayal at Club Low, which I believe released last year in 22.
Yep.
And the first three all play very similar, with Club Low having sort of a major mechanical sort of divide.
Yep.
A shift. Let's talk about the first three for a bit, though, because, again, we're not going to delve into them too much, but I think as far as the world and the greater sort of motifs and themes going on, they're very important.
Yes.
I want to mention, by the way, so Off Peak itself is free. All the other games cost money. We have not, full disclosure, we have not actually played ourselves the Norwood Suite or Tales from Off Peak City.
Yes.
We are going off of gleaned info.
Yeah. I would really like to play all of these games. These are incredibly interesting games. This is a really interesting developer. But for the sake of this, we're just kind of giving a crash course so that we can talk about Betrayal.
Look, we're not really rolling in money or anything, so like,
yeah. Every day I wake up and I roll around in just spare bits and pieces of cardboard, and I'm like, I wish this was money.
Oh, like board game pieces?
Yeah.
Well, funny you mention that. So, Off Peak, you play as an unnamed character, and you are trying to get on a train. And luckily, to help you out, there's this guy named Luke?
Yeah.
With three U's.
Yeah, three U's. Not when we pronounce Luke like that, that's because it has three U's.
Yeah. Much like how Not had three T's.
Yes.
Yeah, we've got three Z's. Got to have another character with three of the same letter in a row in the next episode so that we can have a threefer.
Yes.
So he gives you a train ticket, but he accidentally scattered it and tore it to bits. So it's kind of scattered all over the train station. And it's up to you to grab those so you can leave the city on a train. Off-Peak is interesting because, so it's a first-person adventure game where you're mainly walking around with WASDA and clicking on things with the mouse button. But there's not a ton of, like, puzzles or quest lines the way there are in most adventure games. For the most part, the things you can click on are people to, like, talk to them. It does this cool thing where, A, all the dialogue is sort of presented as a flat texture that orbits around the model, such that if you walk around somebody, the texture is always readable. It's a really interesting, it's like a flagpole is how I would put it.
Yeah.
Think of like a flag that you can always see the front face of the flag. So if you tried walking around the flagpole, the flag would move. And I mean, people talk to you. One neat thing is that they have sort of voices, which are usually instruments of some sort. making notes.
Yeah, it's like if it's kind of like if Banjo-Kazooie was, you know, like little samples of like a you know, a violin or you know, a guitar getting plucked.
I mean, they kind of do that already for a lot of characters in Banjo, but
true.
I get what you're saying. Yeah, it's very Banjo-esque. Is there a term for that where like it sonically represents letters being typed?
So
a sound font? No, wait, that's something else.
Papyrus? Wait. So the gameplay as it stands is mostly just sort of walking around and clicking on things, but the details of the world and the history of the place that you're staying in tends to be front and center within like actually playing the game.
Yeah. I did want to say one thing, which is that there are things you can interact with other than people, and in Off-Peak, all of them are things you can steal.
Yeah.
like there is a pizza guy. Pizza, huge reoccurring motif.
Yep.
And he's just, you know, baking pizza, selling it there, and you can just eat all of his pizza. And he's like, great, now I don't have any pizza to sell.
Wow, thanks.
There's a record collection that you can just take all the records for and not pay for them. There is some weed cookies.
Yep.
Edibles. There are some sheet music, and you can't even pay for them if you wanted. Like,
yeah.
You literally are either leave them or steal them. So, yeah, dotted throughout the train station are the ticket pieces that kind of just take you on a tour around everywhere. But, yeah, the station is really cool. It's set up like an art gallery almost, more than a train station. Like, the walls are covered with individual pieces of large artwork. Usually, it doesn't really repeat things for the sake of, you know, symmetry or to create more of a realistic public space. It just feels like a canvas that people threw stuff on, or like the main hall of a big art museum where they'll have these larger exhibits sort of hung up or, you know, stuck to the wall.
Now, it's worth noting that while it is like, while it's definitely more forward about like the experience of walking through it, I think that it like, in terms of it resembling a real life place, it keeps its structure a lot more than the later game would of the Norwood Street. Norwood Suite. The Norwood Suite would have like winding corridors and such, whereas this has like slight examples of that. It has like a really tall staircase, for example.
Yeah.
But it doesn't like it. It's a place that I feel like still theoretically could exist in the real world.
Yeah. The main sort of station, like atrium, is huge and open, and that's sort of where most of the game takes place. There is two hallways that splinter off from it, and those hallways have, like, a passage back to the atrium. One of them is, like, a further part down in the train yards where you can talk to somebody who likes trains.
Yep.
And she paints, and she has the weed cookies.
Yep, yep.
And then the other side takes you to the aforementioned big stairwell and also a board game bar, which I just want to point out, Cosmo D knows their shit.
Yes.
This is, I think, something I love. So, like, the jazz albums, real albums, including some by Archie Pelago, which is that's not a pseudonym of Cosmo D. That's, like, a different person, right?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, that one's pretty great. But then there's, you know, there's Coltrane, there's Armstrong, all your jazz hits.
Notably, the reason that you asked that, I believe, is because the music in the game is done by Archie Pelago.
Yeah, and there are Archie Pelago albums in the records. But then, like, going into the board game bar, there's a giant print of MF Doom. Specifically MF Doom, because it's Dr. Doom, but talking about, like, the special herbs.
Yeah.
Which is MF Doom's instrumental series of records. And then there is also, like, people playing board games, and they're real board games. People are playing Netrunner. Out in the station, there are giant versions of, like, Terra Mystica.
Yeah. There's one of the best conversations is in the board game bar where there's like four friends who are trying to play. I don't remember the name of that one board game. It was an older one, like the kind with like Arundel and
Zolkin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like, it's such a good bit because it's like, there's one person who's like trying desperately to get everybody to play the game. There's like two people who don't give a shit. There's, like, one other person who actively wants them to leave.
It's like there's one person who's really into the game and keeps trying to give strategic advice. One person who's trying to enjoy the game despite that person.
Yep.
One person who just wants to leave, and another one who's trying to, like, get the person who wants to leave to stay in the game a little longer.
Yeah.
It's so real.
It's so good.
It's so great. I also, like, they have, like cards from Through the Ages hanging on the walls.
Yeah.
Like, these are board games that are not just things at Target, you know?
Yeah.
These are some good pulls.
I would even say, like, it's not just, like, classics that everyone knows, too.
That, too, yeah.
As somebody who knows a number of the classics but isn't, like, deep into the paint, there were a number that I was like, oh, shit, it's that game. And then there were a number more that I was like, I feel like I should know this game, but, I've never heard of it. Yeah.
Like, I was definitely surprised to see Terra Mystica, but then, like, going on to then see Android Netrunner and have people talk about the strategy of it was really good. I could recognize the cards being played. It was base set Shaper versus base set HB, and the HB player lost because HB sucks. At least in base set.
HB, that's a High Bon Electronics, right?
Yeah, they're in the game.
Okay, good, of course.
Yep.
Unironically, that would be a really good, that would be a really fun thing for
like a custom set.
Yeah.
A custom corp for High Bon Electronics, and then like a custom Nero runner.
Oh god. If there is a Venn diagram, if there is like the one person who is in the Venn diagram of Zootamayo fan and big enough into Netrunner to
Netrunner Pro
to make custom content, please get on that. Anyway,
yeah, so one of the big things that happens in the game is you go up the stairwell, which has like prints in paintings of body parts. It's like a disassembled sort of upper body to where like one of them will have just bones, one of them will have bones and some skin, one just has the nerves.
It's artistically depicted. It's not like,
yeah,
it's not just like, here's a picture of gore.
Yeah. And then when you get to the top after a long time, there is a woman who is peering into the train station from above through like the skylights.
And she's looking for Muriel.
Someone with red hair in an orange coat.
Yes, sorry.
Yeah.
We don't know her name yet.
Yeah, sorry. Strike that from the record.
Yep. Go ahead and censor that.
But as you turn around to head back down, you see these like three, like triplets almost, of girls in like blue trench coats or blue dresses.
Yeah, like blue like work dresses with white hair and sunglasses.
Very mysterious. And they hand you a light blue glowing cow skull that if you click on it teleports you back to the center of the station.
Yep.
Which is great because it means you don't have to go down the stairwell. Yeah.
But also, it's interesting that you can actually see them earlier. Two of the, like, all of them are sitting, like, as though they're waiting for trains. And, one of them is, like, just, you know, laying down, looking at, reading a book. But two of them will follow you one-to-one if you walk around them.
Yeah.
It's slightly creepy, and it's a neat little, like, flash-forward of the creepy thing that's about to happen after.
Yeah. So, once you get on the train, you are stopped by the owner of the train station, who is either A, not happy about you taking the free ticket from Luke and wants you to pay for it, or B, very unhappy because you stole things from all the people selling stuff there and wants you to pay for it.
Now, the funny thing is that the way he's like, you're going to pay for this, is by working at a noodle shop, which we were joking as you were playing this and I was watching, of like, wait, I just want to work at the noodle shop. How can I forget the ticket?
Yeah, there's a ramen shop where like the owner of it's really cool and talking about ramen like it's music and makes a fun dialogue. And he's like, you know, I could really use an extra pair of hands here. And you can go behind the counter, but you can't actually help him or interact with the counter at all.
Yeah.
Which is really sad.
Yeah. But as I think it's Marcus, it's an M name.
It's either Marcus or Marv.
Yeah. It's Mo. You dingwat. You stole all the pizza.
It's not Mo. Yet.
But as he's about to be like, you'll sling ramen for me to pay off your debt, Muriel shows up, who is the lady with red hair and a yellow dress.
Orange
dress. Orange hair and a yellow dress.
And she takes you away, and now you are joining the circus.
Yep.
So, what is the circus?
Good question. The circus is the tent that has cats playing in it, where Steve plays old Deuteronomy. Hang on, wait. Sorry, I'm getting my okay. So the circus is a like a secret society sort of thing that apparently kind of like does missions in Off-Peak. We're not 100% sure like what they, you know, what their ultimate goal is, but they seem to be more on the good guy side than on the not good guy side.
Yeah, so here's where we start to get into sort of the world of Off-Peak. It is a very interesting world. Off-Peak 1, the train station we've been talking about, doesn't super delve into, like, the overarching sort of conflicts going on, and we'll touch on those as we go through the games very briefly. But the circus are some sort of shadow organization that may have some amount of magic powers given the teleportation.
Yep.
And they are interested in... Or they're on the side of, like, justice and anti-corporate takeover.
Yes.
I think I want to go ahead and mention that there is a very heavy anti-corporate theme throughout the series.
Yes. One of my favorite lines in the game is the lady who sells weed cookies. It's a line that stuck with me, and it's like, it's one of the simple pleasures, although nowadays it feels like simple pleasures are all anyone has left.
Yeah.
It's like, that hit me hard. To briefly mention some other players that we'll touch on very briefly, but will be a little more prevalent when we get to Betrayal. Modulo is seemingly the like music record company that is a major player in Off-Peak. They seem to be the ones who are kind of like buying out various places and you know, doing corporate things with them. It's also worth noting that all of the guards in, I think, every game look exactly the same, and I love it.
Yeah.
It's such a good, iconic guard design, because it's like literal pale white, you know, skin, like mannequin-looking skin, big ol' shades, and then, like, a brown, like, officer jacket and, like, officer hat. It's, like, it's incredibly iconic, and it also, like... I feel like there's a slight amount of, it feels like there's at least a little bit of ACAB in the games.
Yeah.
Just because, like, I love how they're kind of portrayed as, like, this dumb monolith who just sort of exists just to, like, you know, get in your way, more or less.
Yeah, they feel like a cross between Arnold Schwarzenegger and that one image of Adam Jensen that people use as their profile picture from Deus Ex.
Yeah.
But if you, like, splashed a bunch of white paint on him.
Yeah.
It's so... It kind of reminds me of Arnold's performance as Mr. Freeze in Batman. Like, definitely a sort of beef muscle guy. It's also kind of dubious how much they are public defenders versus, like, private police, and I think that's really interesting.
What's the difference between the two?
It's also worth noting, by the way, Muriel and the circus are going to come up multiple times. The player, I think, it's a little up in the air whether or not the player is the same person in every game or a different person in any game. My general assumption is I believe it is meant to be kind of the same player, but it's more just worth noting that, like, because it's all first-person perspective and because you can choose your name, there's not, like, a single consistent, like, through line exactly.
Yeah, you're never given a name. Only in the later games can you actually choose a name. In the first two, you can't. And you don't even see what the player looks like until the third game. And even then, it's pretty vague. And then, like, it's unclear how much of it is carried over. I don't think there's a true answer. It's written in such a way that it could be the same character.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it could be just four different people if you wanted. It's sort of role-playable that way.
Yeah. It's probably a measure of, like, you know, this is either somebody coming in from the previous games, or this is somebody coming in and this is their first game, as was the case with Club Low with us two.
Yeah, but so before we move off of Off-Peak, I just want to say that, like, I find the things being sold super interesting. As I said, pizzas will come up later. Cookies don't really come up later, from what I can tell, but pizzas play a huge part. But with music, it's very important because in a lot of ways, it feels like a world where music is the main form of media beyond, like, movies and TV.
Yeah.
Like, there's very few references to movies or TV in any of the games. And instead, it feels much more like music is this huge cultural phenomenon, this giant force. Because, like, you know, the jazz records are important enough to sell at, like, this train station. But also the sheet music, the person selling it says that, like, the secondhand sheet music market's huge. Like,
yeah.
So many people play instruments or are learning instruments to where there's, like, an important big market for selling and reselling and buying sheet music, which is just not how it is in real life.
Yeah.
Like, especially playing an instrument versus buying and listening to CDs or records, you know, it's a completely different audience.
Yeah.
But in Club Low, or in Off-Peak, it feels largely the same. Similarly, like, you could view the amount of art in this public train station as sort of a depiction of a world where art like that is valued much more in public spaces. Like, art that's transgressive and loud and unique and creative versus, like, corporate art.
Yeah. It's really interesting because it's, like, in this and in Club Low, there's this interesting little dichotomy where it's, like, these are spaces that have, like, a lot of art, a lot of music, a lot of, like, a lot of, you know, transgressive media, but they're also owned by, like, mob-esque figureheads.
Yeah.
Who, you know, are, like, clearly somewhat reviled because they're the big boss man.
So, I also want to mention a few things. A, Off-Peak City is perpetually nighttime.
Yep.
It's pretty much always depicted as being nightlife, whether that's, like, people actually just only do things during night, or you are a creature of the night, if you will. And then B, it's partially flooded.
Yeah!
Like, when you're leaving with Muriel and the triplets, you're on a boat. And I think they even talk about, like, paddling a boat to the train station.
Yeah! One of the first things you see when you get to the train station is, like, a thing that's, like, the trains won't be running here. And it's, like, your options of leaving, and there's pictures of, like, putting a boat in, just swimming. So it's, like, you know, it's a city that's built around the flooding Venice style.
Yeah, either that, or it's, like, a part where, maybe not built around, but flooding has happened and it's adapted.
Yeah.
Like that one movie, what was the name of it?
Oh, God.
You know the one, though. It was like one where about a guy who looks at people's memories.
Yeah.
And he, like, tries to solve a crime.
Oh, God. We watched this for a movie night and I can't remember
the
name.
Yeah, leave a comment in the episode on if you know what the movie was.
Go ahead and give us a like and a subscribe down there. Rate us 5 stars. Anyway. Yeah.
So, Norwood Suite is the next one. It's the first proper mission, and the mission is Muriel has given you a CD that you have to play for DJ Bogart. DJ Bogart is an accomplished popular DJ who does, like, weekend-long marathon shows at an old hotel called the Norwood Suite, essentially, or the Norwood Hotel. Norwood was an old jazz musician who was incredibly famous and popular, but has since disappeared mysteriously. And so, as you go through the Norwood Hotel, A, you find that there are no vacancies. They do not rent out the hotel, except for the fact that they kind of do, because there are things in hotel rooms. And being the adventure game protagonist you are, your job is to snoop in hotel rooms to find things.
Ah, snooping around as usual, I see. Sorry, snooping as usual, I see.
This is also where Modulo is properly introduced. Modulo is here to buy the hotel, as it has since become a, like, major music venue, whereas the current owner does not want to sell it,
yeah,
but the contract owners do.
So this one has a lot more quests where you like get things for people and people give you things. It's much more adventure gamey. Ultimately, the goal is to get a costume to go into the dance where DJ Bogart's playing. And the costume you end up getting is one of Norwood. So what happens is you go through different rooms and you investigate things. And then these open secret tunnels that lead you back to the lobby. And the tunnels all sort of depict Norwood floating in a void surrounded by musicians.
Yeah.
And the music gets all weird and interesting. There's a lot of, like, layering where, you know, you go to a certain area and only one track will play, but the tracks will overlap in such a way that no matter where you're standing, you'll hear something. It's a technique that's used oftentimes in these sorts of walking simulator type games to create a very rich soundscape that changes the way the landscape changes, that by like moving from one place to another, rather than a hard cut between songs, it slowly transitions as like the percussion is swapped out or the melody is crossfaded.
Yeah.
You know, sort of the way it would be if you were to walk between rooms with different things on the speakers. But these tunnels eventually lead up to the final tunnel, which is like a one-way passage that you enter and you see Norwood being like people are playing trombone at him.
Yeah.
And then they're like carrying him off to a blue door. And that's the last you see of Norwood, and, you know, the most you know of his disappearance, other than the fact that, like, so you go down, you meet up with DJ Bogart, and his manager does not want him to hear the CD, but he's like, nah, I want to, forget it. And so he takes his elevator up to his private room. When you go on the elevator, plastered on the walls are pictures of Norwood's face, but, like, it melts away into, like, Springtrap.
Yeah.
Like a funny skeleton face.
Yeah, it's
like a Terminator, like, face.
Yeah, it's a like, robot skeleton-looking face. It's also worth noting that as you go into that elevator, the, like, sides of the left and right walls, like, go down, and you see, like, a bunch of faces of, I have to assume, previous characters, having not fully seen the playthrough.
Yeah, that's true. It's one of those wacky, weird spatial tunnels.
Yeah.
But this time it's 3D models of characters looking at you.
And they see you off as you ascend.
Yeah. So you get to the main suite, and you see, like, some robot bodies of Norwood, seemingly. And in the bathroom, there's, like, a cloning vat.
Yeah.
And then you play the CD for DJ Bogart. And he explodes, revealing that he is a robot. And out of a side room comes the weird skeleton man. And it ends there.
Yeah. He does a really good walk cycle towards you.
It's so good.
It's so good.
Okay, yeah. We need to talk about the animation.
Yes. Okay. This game is so... I love the animations in all of the series. Betrayal Club Low, we'll talk about it more, but, like, oh my god, it's so, like, funny forward.
Yeah, so, like, for one thing, a note about the art style is that the lighting is, like, super exaggerated oftentimes, with much harsher, like, shadows and bright sides of models, but the models still feel flat, like, they don't have, like, a ton of detail to them. They're not polygonal, but they're also not, like, spruced up.
Yeah,
there is a very, like, economic middle ground between those, and it really gives off a sort of janky vibe. Like,
yeah,
like, you can tell this is a game made mostly by one person, but it's very endearing because of that. I think the
other interesting thing too is that a lot of the character models, if not basically all of them, seem like essentially they were created from, like, pre-generated assets. Not pre-generated,
yeah,
but like default Unity assets, but they've been like they've been sort of tailored in a way to give them a really unique style that I genuinely, and here's your poll for the episode, it looks like the custom character creator screen in Tony Hawk. like where you if you've ever played Tony Hawk, you've had this experience where, like, you choose the hair you want and then you, like, go to the value to, like, change the color. You click it one to the left, and it updates to be the reddest red possible. It's like if that happened, and instead of, like, you know, fixing it to try and make it look, like, you know, more realistic or whatever, the creator was just like, yeah, all right, this person has red hair now.
Yeah, like, there's a ton of high saturation, and, like, when it's dark, it's dark hues.
Yeah.
It sort of feels like either laser tag blacklight or, like, a black velvet painting.
Yeah.
Which really helps the nightlife aesthetic and the circus motif going on. I think, like, though, the models feel like a model in sort of a B game, if you will. But I think that the creator leans into that. One, the faces do have a lot of detail.
Yep.
In the sense that they are unique between them. You don't really see repeat faces that much, unless that's the point. B, there is an uncanniness that creates a very strange atmosphere that fits the world. The world is weird. The models are weird. The people are weird. It's fine. The people act weird and they look weird because they are weird. Everything's weird, but weird affectionate.
Yeah.
I don't want to say Lynchian because that feels too, like, too cliche, but some ways it does.
It's a thing where, like, it feels like the normal in this world is just fundamentally different to the normal in our world.
Yeah. But then also the animations are great because, like, usually they're pretty minimal in a way that feels like Cosmodee couldn't really make complex animations. But when people do move around or do a lot of stuff, it's done in a way that feels sort of loose and imperfect. That, again, makes it feel very janky and like a B game, but it adds so much character, and I think that's really important. Also, Off-Peak does not have a lot of movement.
Yeah.
Like, most people in Off-Peak just stand still and maybe move their arms while they talk, and otherwise move their neck. I think most of the actual, like, mobility that NPCs express is just in the final cutscene.
Yeah.
Norwood Suite has a bit more with, like, the dance floor, but there's still sort of loops, and I think looping animations are used pretty frequently throughout the rest of the series. But yeah, this also gets into Human Resource Horizons, which is the robotics and cloning company behind sort of the world. This is another of the large corporations, and they seem to have a vested interest in maintaining celebrities.
Yeah.
Because that gets into the third game, Tales from Off-Peak City, which is the one that I kind of know the least about. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. We mainly wanted to do the episode on Club Low.
Well, fortunately for you, I also don't know a single thing about this game, so we can just skip it.
But the important thing I know is that this is a game that is debatably... It's unclear if you're working for the circus or not, but someone sends you on a mission to get a job at a pizza place to steal a saxophone from a guy named Caetano.
Yes.
The thing is, this Caetano is not the real Caetano. This is a robot that HRH, Human Resource Horizons, made to replace the dead Caetano, but this Caetano was not good at playing music, and so he decided to, you know, stop being a musician and open up a pizza joint. That and, like, the bits of Norwood being sort of revived feel like they are trying to sort of recycle genius or talent, but they're really just unable to. It's sort of like using dead celebrities' likeness with AI, you know?
Interesting. Yeah.
And there's sort of, it feels like there is an implication that Bogart is like a copy of young Norwood. He has similar sideburns and similar facial hair. He wears the same clothes, and obviously he's in the same room as all the Norwood clones are.
Yeah, and, like, that coupled with the fact that, like, you get the like, Norwood melted face ascension before you see his melted face, and, like, the room being littered with clones and stuff as well also kind of implies that, like, he is sort of the current imperfect incarnation of Norwood.
Yeah, but he was at least able to DJ pretty well.
Yes.
Yeah, it seems like Modulo and HRH are in on it together, and the circus wants to stop both of them because the CD that you give to Muriel blows up Bogart's head. So that's probably also why Muriel is, like, okay with helping you steal the saxophone from Kaitano. Because, like, in some ways, Kaitano doesn't need it anymore, because this is not the real Kaitano. But this is also a Kaitano that has come to terms with he's not the real one, and has sort of escaped the destiny he was given of die or become perfect.
Yeah.
And then that gets us into Betrayal at Club Lo.
Okay, so this game is incredibly interesting.
Your mission, as you're tasked by Muriel, who now has blue hair and pronouns, is to go into Club Lo, a nightclub where a fellow circus worker named Gemini J has been running an undercover operation. However, there's a chance he gets caught or blows the stuff. So you need to get him out of there before Big Mo, the sort of mobster boss that runs the place, figures him out. How do you do that? Well, that's what we're going to talk about now with gameplay.
Yes.
So this plays completely differently from the previous games.
The gameplay, I think, is what hit a lot of people to this being such an interesting idea, because it is a build your own dice kind of game.
A dice builder.
A dice builder, you could say.
Mm-hmm.
So the way that this works is that your disguise is a pizza person. Somebody who, you know, a pizza delivery person. And generally, like, as you go around the club, like, for example, just step one is getting into the club. And then, you know, step two is, like, there's a whole bunch of different ways that you can go about, like, going through the kitchen and then getting in, or, you know, going in through the front door if you can convince the guard to let you in, that sort of thing. But the main gameplay here is that you earn money, tips, typically.
Yep.
And the money lets you buy new faces on the dice. So, as an example, let's say you have a dice that's your one of your mental stats, and it has the faces of, like, 000112. The higher the face, it's going to cost a little bit more money to actually, up that one up. So the 2 is going to be more expensive than the 0 or the 1. Or there's also the option to plus 1 to all faces of the die for a heavier investment. But I believe technically there's, like, more of a discount. So, you know, strategy, like you do. The game is designed specifically and explicitly for you to be able to, like, pause gameplay at any point and up whatever die is most relevant right now. But what's also very interesting is that you have modifiers.
Mm-hmm.
These modifiers can be things like you're wet because you tripped in a puddle, or you're overconfident, or you're anxious, what have you. And so these modifiers are their own dice that will roll for different things. For example, if if you're overconfident, let's say, and you're trying to pass a speech check, overconfidence dice might be like -1, -1, 000, +2. Ah. Here's the interesting thing is that a lot of the die, like, there are die that are primarily harmful that, like, will sap one of your health or one of your mental energy, which are your 2 health bars, but there's also dice that can help you quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so managing, like, essentially managing your emotions is, like, a big part of the game where, like, you know, let's say you have a heavy negative modifier and you have to convince a guard to let you pass. But you could also go to, you know, a much lower level thing. You could go to, you know, talking to the front desk person and do a speech check with them that burns the, you know, -2 die or whatever you have so that you can get rid of that particular ailment and maybe even get a helpful ailment that lets you, you know, do things with the other guard. It's like it's a really fun, like, interconnected sort of, like, choose the way that you go about solving the problems kind of game.
Yeah.
Another
thing to note is that, so you have your modifiers, you have your main stats, and then you have pizza.
Yep.
So the pizza is one of the main ways you get tips. Essentially, this is also a bigger part of dice building. The idea is that there are 3 pizza ovens throughout the game, and when you go to these, each time you go to a first one, you get a new pizza. And then later on, you're able to customize the pizza. You get pizza toppings throughout the game, and each topping is a die face that you add onto a pizza, and these pizza dice are always rolled whenever you roll dice.
Yes.
And these can oftentimes give you money, just flat out. They can also give you extra health or mental health back. Sometimes they give bonuses like re-rolling things or maybe adding plus one. But yeah, they're always rolled.
They're always rolled and they're always helpful.
I also want to add that other than that, you get $1 for every point that you exceed a check by.
Yeah.
So like rolling high numbers is really good because not only does it mean you pass the roll, but it also means that you get more money. And because of this, you can plan out what you're doing so that like you have a really high stat, you make a roll that's relatively easy, you get a lot of money to then boost another stat. And so like the order you do things not only matters for burning certain effects or gaining certain effects, but just getting more tips to then put into your pizza or your stats.
Yeah, it is an incredibly interesting gameplay system. I love it so much. I would love to see another, like, I don't think every game in the Club Low, in the Off-Peak. Yeah, in the Off-Peak series, I don't think every game needs to be a betrayal at Club Low, but I would love to see at least, like, one or two more games use this gameplay. It's yeah. Such an interesting thing.
It's very replayable. Every sort of objective has, like, three, at least, optional different ways to go about it.
Yes.
So, like, there are, let's say, for example, there are laser gates. There's a few of these throughout the club, and for all of them, they're like security gates, you know. You can try to just pass through. I don't think that works.
It doesn't work unless you've, like, heavily invested in, like, one of your strength yeah. stat or whatever.
You can hum a tune to the laser frequency, which uses your music stat.
Right, yeah, I'm gonna pull up the stats, by the way, just so we can...
I tried looking it up, and I couldn't find it.
Oh god, really?
I'm fine.
Alright, I found your stats. Your stats are cooking, deception, music, observation, physique, wisdom, and wit.
Yeah, pretty good set of stats there. Only one is necessarily physical, which is neat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really, really fun, too, because all of the different roles that you can do tend to have their own little animations. Like, for example, as just a brief example before we get to the main gameplay again, you can pickpocket multiple people. And when you do, your pickpocket animation is, like, you crouch slightly, and then you do, like, this thing where, like, you reach forward and pinch, like, with your fingers multiple times, like you're a crab. It's such a good, like, yo-ho, I'm gonna steal from ya, animation. Wonderful animations, 10 out of 10. Based off of earlier work, clearly Cosmodie has gotten better at animating really, really funny, really, really jank 3D models.
Yeah.
And big fan. Huge fan.
People always dance in this place, and it's great. The yep. dances are great. So, a few other things about it. Some characters will have a lot of checks, and against them, there are some things you can do to give you bonuses against them. Like, for example, there is I think the manager has a few like this, where, like,
yes.
if you catch him, like, secretly doing something he shouldn't be, he's weak to you because you now have dirt on him.
Yep.
He's like cooking the books on a contract or trying to fire the DJ, which, by the way, Chad Blueprint, great DJ name.
Yeah.
He's also canonically the protege of DJ Bogart from Norwood Suite, so there's some fun crossover there.
Yeah. He also just looks wonderful.
Yeah.
A lot of good character models in this game.
He looks like an Oblivion character.
He does.
That's what the models look like. They look like Oblivion yeah. characters most of the time, and it's kind of beautiful.
We're not going to talk about, like, every individual check, but to give you a little idea, for example... Like you said with the laser doors, there's typically multiple ways to do the same thing, even when it comes to, like, broader things. For example, there are three ways to get into the club, and depending on what you do, you might even end up opening up all three, because all three kind of have their own benefits. But there is literally the front door, where you have to convince everybody in line to let you go forward by distracting them with a dance, I think, is one.
You can give them pizza.
Yep, you can give them pizza. And then you actually have to convince the guard to let you through as well. There is a back door where a guard is sleeping, which introduces another fun thing where there's checks that you can only make once. So, you know, if you fail them in a playthrough, then you failed that one particular check this playthrough. But I believe you can pickpocket the guard for like a key or something.
Mm-hmm.
But the back door, if you can convince him to let you through, gets you to the kitchen, which is its own thing as well. And then there is the fire escape, which gets you up and actually gets you access to Chad Blueprint really early.
And the manager, specifically.
Yes. I believe my first way I ended up coming in was actually that way as well.
Yeah, definitely.
The club as it exists has like a bunch of different little ways to get around to the same goals. That, like, feels very good to experiment with and feels very good to just stumble across something that you wouldn't even think would work.
Mm-hmm. Another thing, there are two permanent stat boosts that are just flat stat boosts. And these are locked behind really difficult checks or, like, encounters. One of them is a mask that you get from somebody on the dance floor who turns out to be Chad Blueprint's mom.
Oh, yeah.
Who really wants to support him, but Chad Blueprint gets embarrassed whenever he sees his mom, so she wears a mask.
Right.
And the mask helps you with, like, weight or wisdom checks with people. Then, also, there's a security room that's really hard to get into to start off with, and then you have to contend with the security guard in the security room.
And then
you have to contend with the computer that does its best to just harm you for trying to hack it.
Yeah.
But if you do all of that, you can merge your mind with the computer to gain, like, full knowledge on the security of the building, including the location of a secret room. Ah. And it also, like, gives you a bonus with every check going forward.
It's also fun and interesting, too. The security room is the main menu.
Yeah. The main menu has a list of TV, or has like a setup of a bunch of monitors.
And a ball pit.
Yep, and a ball pit.
And a chair, all of which is just one-to-one laid out in that particular guard room. It's also worth noting that oftentimes when you convince somebody to leave, the way that they leave is they T-pose and just rocket ship up.
Yeah.
It's so good.
It's so great. Or sometimes they'll, like, dance and then rocket ship up.
Yeah.
Which usually happens with a lot of the employees.
Yeah. Usually with a loud crash.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, ultimately, the goal is to talk to Big Mo and use an opportunity to get Gemini Jay out of there.
Yeah.
When you talk to Big Mo, he has a really difficult check for every single stat, and it's really hard to beat all of them. I think no matter what, he gets suspicious of you to some extent.
Yeah.
But it's a matter of sort of what you do afterwards. There's a number of endings all based on various things like how much you are able to be cool, how much Big Mo trusts you, which exit you take. Mainly the be cool part and the which exit part, though.
Yeah.
But all the things you do with Big Mo are also tied into other events in the club.
Yeah, for example.
Like, a few main quest lines. There is the kitchen, where you have to finish the, like, soup or the chili that Big Mo likes. And if you're a good enough cook, you can, you know, make it real nice. You can also use wisdom to improve the recipe. You can use wit or deception to actually make it worse.
Yeah.
Just, like, spike it with something. There is the crowd who can get on your side in one ending to help you out against Big Mo.
Yep.
And to make the crowd on your side, you can give drinks to them for free. You can dance with them and show off your cool dance moves. You can adjust the mixing on the, like, soundboard. And, of course, you can just DJ for them.
Yes, if you can convince Chad Blueprint to leave, which is its own little quest line that I don't know if we'll get too deep into. But if you can do so, you can take the reins as the DJ and get the crowd on your side by becoming a wonderful DJ.
I also want to mention that when you do DJ, you just use pizzas instead of records.
It's so good.
It's so good. Keep that in mind later.
Yeah.
And then the owner of the club also asks you for some help with some things.
This is one of the most interesting little bits as well. So the manager asks your help, and if you can do some solids for the manager, then she'll do some solids for you. But one of the things that you can do is basically rat out the employees.
Mm-hmm.
And this was such a fun little ethical quandary because, like, the person at the front is recording the set to sell it on the black market. Which, like, I saw that and I was like, yeah, okay, I'll mention that.
The person at the front is also, I'm pretty sure, like, a socialist.
Yeah.
Like, reading some like, magazine in secret about, like, how to overthrow the ruling class.
Yep. And then the person behind the bar mentions that I think he's planning a walkout. He's, like, essentially planning to strike and to, like, try and, you know, create a union. And that was the moment that I was like, ah, shit, no, I cannot rat this man out.
Yeah, it seems like the bartender is also just kind of shit at his job.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, they're the person who's willing to bartend at this club.
Yeah.
So, essentially, here's where the endings start to diverge. No matter what happens, you're able to distract Big Mo long enough to get Gemini J out of there.
Unless you fail, which is, you know, its own set of endings, but...
Sure.
Most of the endings involve actually getting out.
You get out of the building, but from there, there's a few different things.
Right.
So, in a lot of them, Big Mo will confront you, and you will be captured, usually. One of these, you are sent to the, like... Horizon headquarters to be a sort of resident chef, which essentially just means you're a prisoner making pizza for them.
Yeah.
And there's also this big, like, octopus that Big Mo keeps around that you don't really notice till this ending. There is one where you are captured and sent to a, like, DJ battle royale in the DJ dome. But most of those are just bad endings. In some of these, Gemini J just leaves you.
Yeah.
He's on a unicycle, by the way. That's his circus thing. He's a unicyclist. And he just kind of teeters back and forth before leaving. Muriel's even like, come on, get in the fucking car, Jay. And he just doesn't. And there are endings where you convince him to join you and Muriel and you go back to the circus headquarters. Mo is too late and does not realize he's been had until you've already left. And you get caught in traffic. Now, here's the big thing. The secret room that the computer lets you know about is behind the sort of VIP area where Big Mo is. And it's a little crawl space where there is a radio set up.
Yeah.
And if you pass some checks with the radio, you actually learn that Gemini J is a double agent working for something called the Octagon. It's unclear as of now what the Octagon is, but it is another secret group that seems to want to take down similar targets to the circus.
Yeah. I don't know if the Octagon has showed up in the previous games. I don't think it has. Yeah, this might be a new layer, essentially. I believe
it's the first... Yeah, this is the first introduction of the Octagon, a rival group. You can join the Octagon with Jay. You can also convince Jay to stop working for the Octagon, but either way, the agent who you talk to on the radio agrees to, like, help you out for now.
Yeah.
Because it's in both of your best interests to get Jay out of there. And the kitchen and the crawl space both lead to a car underground in a garage.
The car is the, like, store page logo. It's the, like, skull car. It looks super fucking cool.
Mm-hmm. And I believe this is what the owner gets you, is the car keys.
Yeah.
You can also just hotwire the car if you want, or you can, like, whisper to it to convince it to help you out.
That's a fun thing. A lot of the doors, you can, like, slide a nice note under to try and convince them to open. It's a very, like, the game is, like, 80% somewhat realistic, and then, like, 20% every once in a while you get a really funny check. That's just like, you know, whisper to the, like, listen to the soup and like, you know, see what it tells you, that sort of thing.
It's kind of like Disco Elysium in that regard.
Yeah.
Where, like, you can't tell if the main character is weird or if there is some amount of just supernatural nonsense.
Like, I have to assume it's the latter, but at the same time, I was trying so desperately not to make parallels to Disco Elysium, but yes.
Yes, we've opened the floodgates. This was compared to Disco Elysium a lot.
Yeah.
Being released in similar time frames, both as sort of not quite CRPGs, but investigation-based dice rolling games.
Yeah.
It's just Disco Elysium is much more RPG directly, whereas this one has these like dice building board gamey elements.
Now, I think it is important to talk about Club Low itself because it has some history.
Hold on. I just wanted to say one thing is that either way, you can get out of the car and you can either drive to the Octagon headquarters or to the circus headquarters. And then also there's an ending where you watch tennis, which is what the security guard was watching on the monitors. So that's fun. Okay, Club Low.
Club Low. Club Low, one of the best things about it is there are the non-NPCs you can click on will tend to give you just like a little nugget of lore. So Club Low itself used to be a coffin factory.
Mm-hmm.
It was owned and operated. I think it was like seemingly a like family business type thing. But it fell on hard times like you tend to do and ended up having to, you know, ended up becoming a vacant building that was then bought out and turned into Club Low, and they kept a lot of the branding and stuff because it's good branding. But some of the, like, the lore is so incredibly, it has a vibe. It has a vibe to it is the best way to say it. Because it's like, it's something where like one of the walls you can look at has a bunch of tools, and it notes that like all of the tools have names. It tells you a couple of the names,
mm-hmm.
like the saw's name or whatever. It also like there's usually a little blurb about sort of the history and how things have been converted. There's some kind of like, you know, mention of urban decay oftentimes. And it feels very in theme for a lot of Cosmo-D's work because it really seems to, I think Cosmo-D has a deep love for like the you know, the unseen history of cities, of like individual buildings in cities. And it's like, it's such a interesting, you know, so many interesting little pieces of history that like feel really somber in a game that is also very, you know, obviously goofy.
Yeah.
It like, you know, it's something about like the fact that there's a clear story here that we'll never know fully because of how many remodelings and, you know, refurnishings and stuff this place has gone through.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I don't think it's like dour either. Like, you know, the whole theme about music and stuff is still there, about how people kind of like tend to use music as an escape, but that music can also like be just a generally good thing, be, you know, something like very fun that people can use to express themselves. And so it's like, it's not like, it isn't something that's like, you know, making a point about how Club Low is now bad, but it's more so like an open question of like, how much of this history have we lost, and are we truly better for having lost it? Like,
yeah, there is this really interesting running theme of sort of repurposing and recycling, because the club is a recycled factory for, you know, a coffin factory, which, by the way, is Club Low just the building next to Bob's Burgers?
Yes. It's both buildings next to Bob's Burgers, technically.
The Norwood Hotel has been turned from a hotel proper into a music venue specifically. And then the train station is still being used as a train station, but there is a feeling that it is kind of being sort of, what's the word, like weaned off of being a train station. That its purpose has sort of outlived that of transportation. The trains aren't moving when you get there, and there's a feeling that like, only one train is really going to move anyways, and instead it's used as like, you know, there's a restaurant, there's a garden, there's art, there's a board game cafe, there's art, there's art.
it's an art museum cafe that also has trains there occasionally. And it's then, like the it's like Whistle Stop. Shout out to Whistle Stop. If my fellow St. Louis natives remember, then I'm sorry for bringing it up, because I'm also sad about Whistle Stop just sort of permanently closing.
Shout outs Union Station?
Yeah, shout out to Union Station.
Sort of. Also, shout outs to City Museum, for that matter. Yeah. A lot of ways, Norwood Suite in particular feels like a Meow Wolf sort of immersive theater, or like, you know, Burnt City or Sleep No More. And just sort of the way that rooms are constructed and that the space is designed in particular, it's hard to say in the ways that it doesn't feel like a video game space, but Yeah. I don't know. Maybe that, like, it's bigger than most video game spaces would be in terms of individual rooms and hallways. It tends to feel more like a space that people are meant to walk in than characters.
It's a small puddle, but it's very deep. It focuses in on one building, but it constructs that building in a way that feels very natural to, like, how this space would theoretically come about.
Yeah, it's a big dollhouse. And that's just why I wanted to bring that up, is because those places are inspired by the City Museum and are sort of connected to the City Museum. And that's similar to this. And there's strings to pull there. And City Museum is also a really cool place as far as recycling goes. Please check that out. We might do an episode or something about it in the future.
We're gonna have to make a podcast about St. Louis at some point.
Oh god, I have like 5 things of St. Louis history to talk about. But I also wanted to mention all of this recycling, because there's a lot of recycling done outside of those sort of motifs. There's the recycling of celebrities through robots and stuff like that.
Yep.
And clones. But also, DJing is recycling.
Yeah.
It is taking existing media and repurposing parts of it to create something entirely new. Likewise, you could think of sheet music as a form of recycling compositions done by other people and turning them into a new performance. The performance and the composition are sort of viewed as two separate things. Like, for example, in music law, I guess, you can copyright your own performance of a piece, but you can't, that doesn't mean you own the composition.
Yeah.
If I perform Shostakovich, that's my own version of that, and that's not owned by the Shostakovich estate, which is why, like, Ludwig and Schlott made that copyright-free version of a bunch of classic compositions.
Yeah.
Because their performance can now be reused for free, even though they didn't create the song originally. So it's a sort of recycling in that regard. And then the assets of the games often feel recycled.
I was about to say, like, I not to get full, you know, like, meta or anything, but, like, you know, the game itself plays into the, like, jank asset flippy nature of how it looks very well.
Even, you know, as far as just using real life stuff like board games.
Yeah.
It's so interesting in that regard how it is a game built upon other things, about a world built upon itself, repurposed buildings, reused buildings, and there's also the running theme of just death.
Yeah.
Like Norwood is dead. The city is dead. There's the dead cow skull is a major icon throughout the series. It's like the logo for the series.
Yeah.
It appears on the walls of the train station. It's also what the triplets held in their hand. It is on the gate to the Norwood estate, or the Norwood Hotel. It is hanging on the wall of the security room in Club Low. And I want to say there's another cow skull somewhere, like, in the front entrance.
I'm fairly certain that the car is, the skull on the car is a cow skull.
Yeah. Like, that is reusing a literal carcass for art.
Yeah. And, like, coupled with the fact that, you know, it's literally a coffin factory repurposed as a nightclub as well. Like,
yeah.
Capital T themes.
There's often a sense, I think, in music, especially with jazz, that, like, you are building on the shoulders of not just giants, but dead giants.
Yeah.
Like, Louis Armstrong and Coltrane aren't alive as far as I know.
Unless they're hanging out with Elvis.
But, like, they are important figures in jazz history. People will still buy records of theirs to hear their performances of their music.
Yeah.
And, like, there's all these jazz standards that are just, like, jazz standards as a concept are just people know these songs that old dead jazz musicians played so well that they do their own versions constantly.
Yeah.
Like jazz is sort of a scene that is enamored with the dead greats. And I guess in a way, so is fine art and, you know, art as sort of a whole. And so comparing those two in such a way with just a dead cow skull really shows sort of the identity of Off Peak.
Yeah. I also think that, like you said, there's to tie it all together, I think that with a lot of those themes in mind, it's clear that like the sort of recycling of celebrity and the, you know, the recycling of like property and such has a bit more of a clear message, where it's like, you know, these are companies that are happy to drag out, you know, dead names, or happy to remodel dead buildings and strip away the things that, you know, made them who they are in order to turn a new profit. And so, like,
they're also probably happy to dead name.
Also, yes.
I'm sorry, that was a bit of a non sequitur. Yeah, it's so, I think also it fits the mood of the world as sort of a mood where people mostly just get by with like a little bit of life from like music and artwork. It in a way, people working, you know, corporate work are the real zombies, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Like, they are emotionally dead until they can be revived by art.
Yeah.
That's me.
Yeah, mood.
Mood. or moo.
Ah. Yeah, the Betrayal at Club Low is a really, really interesting game. Cosmodee is a wonderful creator. Cannot encourage you to check out their stuff more, like, enough. I would be surprised if this is the last episode we ever make on Cosmodee stuff.
Yeah, I can't wait for the fifth installment of this world, because it's so beautiful.
Yeah.
And I hope that the relative success of Club Low encourages them to pursue it further.
Yeah. I would love another episode in the Off-Peak City series as well. I think both of us really want to play episode one.
Yeah.
To like really fully experience it. And the fact that it's episode one tells me that there's going to be more in that particular series, maybe, you know, interspersed in between new games and such.
I mean, it could be a bit where there's only one episode, though.
True. And you know what? I would also be fine with that. That would also be pretty funny.
Yeah.
Just as so long as Cosmodee keeps creating, I will keep listening, because, oh my goodness, love this. Love this series. It's a great argument for, like, hey, if you have a song in your heart, you should sing it. You should create stuff, because, like, clearly Cosmodee came from a place of, you know, like, not having the most experience in this stuff, and made such an interesting series, such an interesting world, and such a suite of interesting games.
Huh, a suite. I get it.
Ah.
I get it. Like a hotel suite and a musical suite.
Yeah.
Wait, is that the is Norwood suite a double entendre? I didn't realize that until now, that it could also refer to a musical suite.
Ah. Cosmodee, if you want to come on the podcast episode and confirm or deny that particular theory for us.
Yeah. Or you could come on and talk about Kid Amnesia.
Yep.
the video game version of it specifically.
Yeah. This is probably one of the better fitting ones that we've had.
One of the more likely ones.
Yeah. It's like getting on Tony, like how we should get on Tony Pat's Cop to talk about like Monument Mythos or something.
Yeah.
Or Banksy, famously, we're going to get on when we talk about Mark Echo's Getting Up.
Yep. Or Kikiyama to talk about Off, which is probably the one furthest.
Yeah.
I think Banksy's more likely than Kikiyama, literally. Somehow.
But yes.
But even if you're not any of those people, you can follow us on any podcasting platform you like. Give us a like, give us a rating, give us a review, let us know how we're doing, let us know what you think we'd like, or things we should check out, things we could discuss in future episodes, you know, celebrities notwithstanding. You can follow us on Twitter, yeah, we're still calling it that, where you can get updates on upcoming episodes, get some teasers, in the form of emoji teasers, which we should have a new batch out in the next few weeks.
Yeah.
Given that this is the end of our most recent set of teasers.
Yes.
And yeah, you can follow that. Keep posted on when new things are going to be coming up. We've got some interesting things cooking for the next few months. spooky month coming up. What could it be? Ooh. What could spooky month be? What could it be? Ooh. What could spooky month be? We're going to have a form of media I don't think we've talked about yet.
No, we haven't.
Which is so interesting. I'll let you stew on that. You can follow me on Twitter at Twakaroo, Twakaroo, where I tweet a lot of pinball scores recently, some takes, some stuff I'm doing, updates on projects I work on, including when I go live on my stream on twitch.tv/twak, where I stream weekdays, usually about 1 p.m. Central Time to 3 or 4 p.m. And recently I've been streaming Cruelty Squad, which I'm almost done with. And also I've been resuming Humongous Mondays, where I've been playing through the Humongous Entertainment point-and-click adventure games and going through them in release order. As of recording, I just finished Pajama Sam 2, which was one of my favorites as a kid. So check that out. And also, you can find me on YouTube at IEatSonic, or no. You can also find me on YouTube at Twak, and you can find my stream VODs at Twak's VODs and Ends on YouTube, where you can see old streams.
As for myself, you can, of course, find me on TikTok and on Twitter at Galen Wilson. That's at GALENWILS0N. I post my hot takes and photos and videos of my cats sometimes. You can find me on YouTube at The Only Galen on YouTube, and you can find me on Twitch at twitch.tv/machinegunvampire. I've been considering that maybe I should stream more, but you know how that is.
He's not going to do it.
I'm not going to do it.
And that's the truth, stranger than reality. That Galen became a podcaster that considers streaming, but may not. And that is the off-peak experience. See ya.